show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271 3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello and welcome to this week's program, where we will continue with the final chapter, the chapter on dedication, of Shantideva's A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. Do you remember the verses that ended the last program? By the merits I've accumulated, may every single being abandon all forms of evil and to perpetually engage in virtue. May they never be parted from the awakening mind, and may they always engage in the Bodhisattva's conducts. May they be cared for by the Buddhas and relinquish the actions of devils. And I read from Kunzang Paldin's commentary, which described the devils whose actions to avoid like this. They come in the guise of one's friends, who say that one already has so much knowledge that one is already endowed with spiritual qualities acquired through past training. Surely just a few recitations will suffice. Similarly, difficult relations will arise between teachers and disciples, and the Dharma will not be expounded and studied. One will have the presumptuous thought that one's ethical discipline is superior, and one will look down on others. And just as it's said that all pleasures of the senses are the sign of evil forces, in the same vein, clairvoyance, gain, respect, and so on are also regarded as the work of demons. By contrast, it is said that lazy people are never hindered by demonic forces, for laziness is itself a demon. On the other hand, those who have wisdom are immune to all such demonic hindrances. As it is said in the condensed Prajnaparamita Sutra, four causes make it hard for bodhisattvas, skilled and strong, to be diverted and subdued by the four demons: abiding in the view of emptiness, not forsaking beings, acting in accordance with one's pledges, and being graced by the Buddha's blessing. I'd like to pick up on some of what Kunzang Paldin refers to here, but first let's briefly define the four demons the Prajnaparamita Sutra mentions. Basically, in Mahayana Buddhism, there are the demon of the aggregates, the demon of the disturbing emotions, the demon of the Lord of Death, and the demon of the Son of the Gods. The demon of the aggregates is a symbol for the way that we mistakenly cling to the five aggregates. That's forms, feelings, perceptions, compositional factors, and consciousness, as having an independent and inherent reality. We think they make up a real and independent I that we firmly believe in and hold tightly to. Then the demon of the disturbing emotions is our addiction to acting out our habitual negative emotions in thought, speech, and action. Tulku Urgen Rinpoche refers specifically to the three poisons, attachment, aversion, and ignorance, that thwart our liberation from cyclic existence. The demon of the Lord of Death symbolizes both the death that cuts our life off and our fear of change, impermanence, and dying. Finally, the fourth demon, the demon of the Son of the Gods, represents our craving for comfort, pleasure, and peace, or, according to Tulku Urgen Rinpoche, distraction in the meditation state and the tendency to postpone practice, which creates obstacles for samadhi. From the viewpoint of the practice of Dzogchen, he goes on to say, the real demon is our conceptual thinking. Falling into conceptualization is the demon. By recognizing our mind essence, all demons are defeated, the four maras are vanquished, and all obstacles are done away with. The main point is to train in that. Now, as you can see, demonic forces in the Buddhist teachings are not necessarily snarling creatures with fangs and horns and carrying tridents. Anything that drags the mind away from the practice of Dharma is regarded as a demon. From friends who tell us to be more relaxed, to disagreements we might have with our teachers, and even powers we might gain through meditation, like clairvoyance. We have to remember, though, that powers such as clairvoyance are not in themselves evil. It's only when they lure us away from the real purpose of Dharma, which is to gain enlightenment, or tempt us to develop negative attitudes like pride, arrogance, and so on, that they do the work of demons. As I understand it, when we have such powers, we can easily be seduced into thinking that we are spiritually advanced, or that we are better than others. Then, of course, pride and arrogance are not far off, but liberation and enlightenment increasingly are. I'm struck by the difference in attitude between teachings that hold that all pleasures of the senses are the sign of evil forces, and the writings of masters like Thich Nhat Hanh, who encourages us to actively look for the pleasures and happiness in our world. For instance, when he talks about drinking a cup of tea with a friend, he says, "Drinking tea or coffee can be one of our daily pleasures if we partake of it fully. How much time do you set aside for one cup of tea?" In coffee shops in New York or Tokyo, people come in, order their coffee, drink it quickly, pay and rush out to do something else. This takes a few minutes at most. Often, there's loud music playing, and your ears hear the music, your eyes watch others gulping down their coffee, and your mind is thinking of what to do next. You can't really call this drinking coffee. Have you ever participated in a tea ceremony? It may take 2 or 3 hours just being together and drinking 1 or 2 cups of tea. The time is not spent talking, only being together and drinking tea. Perhaps you think this is irresponsible because the participants are not worrying about the world situation. But you must admit that people who spend their time this way know how to drink tea, know the pleasure of having tea with a friend. This is the practice of full mindfulness, of making the only instant of life we really have meaningful and blissful. And I think it links back to what Tulku Urgen Rinpoche said about not complicating things with a conceptual mind. In any case, the verse from the Prajnaparamita Sutra, "Four causes make it hard for bodhisattvas skilled and strong to be diverted and subdued by the four demons: abiding in the view of emptiness, not forsaking beings, acting in accordance with one's pledges, and being graced by the Buddha's blessings," says that a bodhisattva strong in four things will not be defeated by the demons. Those four are, firstly, seeing everything through the view of being empty of any inherent independent existence. That's the actual nature of reality. Secondly, bodhicitta, the intention to become enlightened to fully benefit all sentient beings, which is not forsaking beings. Thirdly, keeping the vows and commitments one has taken exceptionally well. And fourthly, experiencing the blessings of the Buddha. Interestingly, the translation uses the words "being graced by the Buddha's blessings," which has echoes of the Christian belief that one is saved by grace. "For by grace are ye saved through faith, and that not of yourselves, it is the gift of God," says Ephesians chapter 2, verse 8, in the King James Version of the Bible. But what grace means, and whether the two religions are referring to the same thing, is perhaps an exploration for another program altogether. In any case, the sutra implies that we should train ourselves well in these four if we want to defeat the negative forces that hinder us from attaining liberation. Now, before we get back to Shantideva's text, let's set our motivation for the program as usual. And also, as usual, focus on the bodhicitta motivation if you can. We are taking part in this program to attain enlightenment to benefit all beings as fully as possible. But if you find that too much, at least motivate to attain your own liberation and enlightenment. These motivations make the program really worthwhile, for then it becomes a cause for complete freedom from suffering, something other motivations cannot lead to. So please, take a short time to set such a motivation. Thank you. And now Shantideva continues, "May sentient beings have lives inconceivably long when in fortunate realms. May they always live in contentment, unfamiliar with even the word death." Here, Shantideva wishes all beings to be born in God, demigod, or human states and have extremely long lives while in those states. Also, he wishes them every wealth and contentment, and that they not even hear of such a thing as untimely death. Implicit in these verses is the wish that beings are never born into the unfortunate realms of the animals, predators, or hells. Kunzen Paldin, in his commentary, writes that in the following verses, Shantideva dedicates to the world becoming a pure land. Now, we went through the concept of a pure land in a program some time back, but for those who weren't with us, or those who don't remember, a pure land is described as a land where a Buddha resides with a multitude of disciples. The well-known Buddhist scholar and translator J.C. Cleary, writing particularly about the Amitabha Pure Land, describes it like this. In the Pure Land, there is no sickness, old age, or death. The sufferings and difficulties of this world do not exist. Those born in the Pure Land come forth there from lotus flowers, not from a woman's womb in pain and blood. And once born, they are received and welcomed by Amitabha and his assistants. They receive immortal transformed bodies and are beyond the danger of falling back into lesser incarnations. They are in direct presence of Amitabha Buddha and the great bodhisattvas Kuan Yin, that's Avalokiteshvara, and Shi Chi, Mahastama Prapta, who aid in their ultimate enlightenment. Those who go to the Pure Land live there among beings of the highest virtue. Beautiful clothing and fine food are provided to them ready-made. There are no extremes of heat and cold. Correct states of concentration are easy to achieve and maintain. There are no such things as greed, ignorance, anger, strife, or laziness. The Pure Land is described metaphorically as resplendent with all manner of jewels and precious things, towers of agate, palaces of jade. There are huge trees made of various gems, covered with fruits and flowers. Giant lotuses spread their fragrance everywhere. There are pools, also made of seven jewels, and filled with the purest water, which adjusts itself to the depth and temperature the bathers prefer. Underfoot, gold covers the ground. Flowers fall from the sky day and night, and the whole sky is covered with a net made of gold and silver and pearls. The Pure Land is perfumed with beautiful scents and filled with celestial music. Most precious of all, in the Pure Land, we are told, not only the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, Amitabha and his assistants, but even the birds and the trees, as manifestations of Amitabha, are continuously expounding the Dharma, the Buddha's teachings. Now, some teachers say that such descriptions of a Pure Land should not be taken literally, but are made to interrupt our ordinary everyday mind based on ignorance and introduce us to the bliss of our Buddha nature. Again, Cleary writes, "The hallmark of Pure Land Buddhism is reciting the Buddha name, invoking Amitabha Buddha by chanting his name. Through reciting the Buddha name, people focus their attention on Amitabha Buddha. This promotes mindfulness of Buddha, otherwise known as Buddha remembrance or Buddha recitation. In what sense is Buddha remembered? Buddha is the name for the one reality that underlies all forms of being, as well as an epithet for those who witness and express this reality. According to the Buddha's teaching, all people possess an inherently enlightened true nature that is their real identity. By becoming mindful of Buddha, therefore, people are just regaining their own real identity. They are remembering their own Buddha nature. Buddha, as such, is a concept that transcends any particular embodiment, such as Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha born in India, or Maitreya Buddha, the future Buddha, or Virachana Buddha, the cosmic Buddha, or Amitabha Buddha, the Buddha of the Western Paradise. Buddha exists in many forms, but all share the same body of reality, the same Dharmakaya, which is formless, omnipresent, all-pervading, indescribable, infinite, the everywhere equal essence of all things, the one reality within and beyond all appearances. So, therefore, in a sense, when Shantideva dedicates that the earth becomes a pure land, he wishes that beings be introduced to their true, unstained, blissful nature beyond the mind of ignorance and illusion. He writes, May there abound in all directions gardens of wish-fulfilling trees, filled with the sweet sound of Dharma proclaimed by the Buddhas and their sons. And may the land everywhere be pure, smooth and devoid of any rocks, level like the palm of the hand, and of the nature of lapis lazuli. For all the circles of disciples, may many bodhisattvas dwell in every land, adorning them with their excellent manifestations. May all embodied creatures uninterruptedly hear the sound of Dharma, issuing from birds and trees, beams of light, and even space itself. May they always meet with Buddhas and their sons, the bodhisattvas. Then may these spiritual masters of the world be worshipped with endless clouds of offerings. May celestials bring timely rains so that harvests may be bountiful. May kings act in accordance with Dharma and the people of the world always prosper. In his commentary on the verse, for all the circles of disciples, may many bodhisattvas dwell in every land, adorning them with their excellent manifestations, Kunsen Paldin says that in monasteries, Buddhas and bodhisattvas and teachers are always depicted as the principal figures surrounded by monks and disciples, while in kingdoms, the king is the main figure who is accompanied by ministers and subjects. In other words, he writes, a main figure encircled by a retinue is a gathering circle or a mandala. He applies this to the bodhisattvas surrounded by their disciples and writes, in all assemblies that are gathered around them, may the multitudes of bodhisattvas in all the excellence equipped with the material provisions resulting from the strength of their merit and miraculous powers and possessed of all the perfect wealth of Dharma, remove the spiritual and material poverty of their followers. May they spread and consolidate the teaching and study of the Tripitaka and the practice of the three trainings. May they increase in strength and longevity, merit, influence, and riches, adorning thus the face of the earth with all such good things. May they live for many long years. And then for the next verse, may all embodied creatures uninterruptedly hear the sound of Dharma issuing from birds and trees, beams of light, and even space itself, he waxes like this. Wherever beings can attain enlightenment, that is in every one of the 10 directions, may they constantly hear in the song of beautiful birds, the king of swans and the king of peacocks, in the sighing of the trees, from shafts of light of sun and moon, and indeed from the sky itself, the sound of the Dharma. This Dharma is profound and vast, and it expresses the four seals. That is, all compounded things are impermanent, all defilements are suffering, all phenomena are empty and without self, and Nirvana is peace. And the three doors of perfect liberation, that is, phenomena are empty, they're beyond all attributes, and they are beyond all aspiration or expectation. And then he quotes sutras, and he doesn't say which, that describe the benefits of hearing Dharma teachings. The first he quotes says, when, O king, this gong resounds, the gong here referring to the Dharma gong, within this land you will enjoy renown, magnificence, your every wish. No terror will there be of adverse foes. The crops and harvests will not wilt. Buddha's blessing will descend upon this place. The demons will be tamed. The hells and all the preta realms, let no one doubt, will cease to be. In Buddha, all will have a constant trust. In Dharma, all will diligently strive. The Sangha will less congregate. The learned will multiply. Attachment, anger, ignorance will dwindle and will cease to be. When the Dharma drum is struck, and when its sound falls on the ears of beings in the four times of day, all those who hear will gain enlightenment. And then he quotes another sutra which goes, when the gong of the three jewels, adored by gods and nagas and the yakshas, has been struck, the uncouth minds of tathikas will be subdued. If such advantages come simply from the resounding of the Dharma drum and gong and so on, Kunsen Paldin comments, there's no need to mention the benefits that come from actually hearing the teachings themselves and from exposition and study of the Dharma. Actually, I wonder if by the Dharma dong, gong and drum, the sutra is not making a metaphorical reference to the teachings themselves, their effects when heard being the same as a mighty drum or gong. And just to explain the word tathikas, This is a Sanskrit word that has been translated into English as forder, one who crosses the ocean of samsara. However, the website Rigpa Shedra states that the Tibetan equivalent, Muttekpa, has more of a sense of someone who makes a step on the edge of the ocean rather than one who actually makes a crossing. Traditionally, Tathirka refers to someone belonging to the non-Buddhist philosophical traditions that essentially believe either in a permanent creator of all things or that things originate without causes and dissolve into nothing. In other words, traditions that hold to one of the two extremes of eternalism or nihilism. Another interpretation holds the word to apply mainly to the Jains. Shantideva's text then goes on, "May all medicines be effective and the repeating of mantras successful. May Dakinis, cannibals and the like be endowed with compassionate minds." Kunzan Paldin claims that the medicines here refer particularly to the four medicines allowed in monasteries. Those are food eaten at the proper time, that's before noon for monks, drinks that may be consumed in the afternoon, a medicine taken over 7 days to cure phlegm, which is a difficulty for meditation, and another medicine monks can take over their whole lifespan also to prevent phlegm. I think, however, if we follow this kind of dedication, we can include all medicines, especially as Shantideva is dedicating not only to people in monastic situations, but to all beings. And perhaps with such a dedication, we can make the wish that drug companies become much more ethical, more concerned with curing the sick people of the world, and less about making lots of money for themselves, often through the exploitation of the ill. The repeating of mantra here refers to the spell-like effect of reciting mantras for a particular purpose. Writes Kunzan Paldin, "May the chanting of the secret words of power, the secret mantras through which all works are successfully accomplished, be swift in bringing the benefits described." On the website Shift Your Life, Jonathan Goldman, the prolific author, musician and teacher, and reputedly an author on sound healing and a pioneer in the field of harmonics, says this about his experience of the science behind working with chanting and reciting mantras. "There are a number of different sciences behind mantric chanting. Some of these are the hard science, physics, psychoacoustics, and so on. Some are spiritual sciences, such as the different yogic practices that work with sound. I write about many of them in my book, Healing Sounds. On one level, one can see that mantric chanting, as observed years ago by Dr. Herbert Benson, helps induce the relaxation response, causing reduction of heartbeat, brainwaves, and respiration. On another level, as Dr. David Shananoff-Khalsa believes, mantric recitation enables the tongue to stimulate the acupuncture meridians inside the mouth, particularly on the roof, thus enhancing health. Dr. Ranjay Singh found that the chanting of specific mantras causes the release of the hormone melatonin and is investigating the importance of this in the healing process. He has found that there are many benefits, including shrinkage of tumors and enhanced sleep because of this. He writes about this in his book, Powerful Self-Healing Techniques. It's also been found that self-creating sounds such as chanting will cause the left and right hemispheres of the brain to synchronize. Such chanting will also help oxygenate the brain, reduce our heart rate, blood pressure, and assist in creating calm brainwave activity. In addition, listening to certain chants has great beneficial effects. Dr. Alfred Tomatis has utilized the sounds of Gregorian monks to stimulate the ears, brain, and nervous systems of clients. His work is very important with regard to the scientific and medical uses of sound and chant. He found that certain sounds that are particularly high in vocal harmonics will stimulate and charge the cortex of the brain and the nervous system. Some years ago, there was a very popular recording of Gregorian chanting that occurred just when this research was being made public. I know that many other types of chanting from different traditions have very similar effects. These are just a few of the hard physical phenomena of mantric chanting that have been observed. There are certainly others as well. Some believe that the recitation of sacred mantras actually causes the physical and etheric bodies to change their vibrational frequency level, becoming more attuned, if you like, with divine energy. Thus, when one chants a mantra for an extended period of time, to invoke, for example, some deity, the higher energies of that deity will encode itself upon the chanter. This is one purpose for much mantric chanting, to become one and unite with the energy of the deity that one is chanting for. If the person has some sickness or imbalance, this imbalance can frequently be released by having the energy of the deity encode itself upon the person. This actually comes from the concept of vibrational as opposed to allopathic medicine, which is the basis of many a healing modality, including homeopathy and acupuncture, that all the universe, including our bodies, is simply made of vibration. A concept, incidentally, that the new superstring theory of physics supports. Everything is in a state of vibration, and when we are in a natural resonant vibration, we're in a state of health. But if some part of the body begins to vibrate at a counter frequency, the energy becomes stuck and disease sets in. Therefore, by mantric chanting, one can cause stuck energy to become released, and we can return to our natural state of resonance, effecting a cure. I have, incidentally, observed this phenomenon many times during workshops. We will be reciting a mantra to invoke a specific entity, perhaps Tara, Tibetan goddess of compassion, for example, in order to better embody the energy of compassion. However, during and after the process, I've seen people with chronic health problems emerge from the chanting quite healthy. It's amazing. He goes on to talk about a kind of epiphany he had when wondering about the role of intention when reciting mantra. Many years ago, I was collecting information and writing a book on the effects of sound to healing. In particular, I focused upon the use of sound to affect the chakras, though, of course, I also looked at the use of sound to affect different organs, as well as different conditions. What I found was that there were different schools of sound healing, based upon different teachers and different traditions. These different schools might use the same mantra to resonate different chakras with great success, or they might use different mantras to resonate the same chakra. Om, for example, could resonate the heart chakra, or it could resonate the throat chakra, or the third eye, or crown, or whatever. It depended upon the path and the teacher. I remember sitting at my desk being quite confused. How could all this work? I distinctly heard a voice saying, "It is not only the sound that creates the effect of the sound, but also the intention of the person making the sound." Suddenly, everything made sense and was clear. I understood. Yes, the intention, the energy behind the sound, was an equal part of the effect of the sound. This energy of intent was carried upon the sound wave and was actually equally responsible for the effect of the sound. It was a major aha moment, and I immediately wrote down the formula, frequency plus intent equals healing. For many people, this has been a sort of unified theory of sound healing because it's able to bring together the differences in many different schools and many different beliefs. And with that, we must now part, for time is up. Please dedicate any positive energy from our program today to the enlightenment of yourself and all sentient beings. Thanks for joining us, and I hope you'll be with us again next week. Have a wonderful week. Goodbye. This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Kawera, kamata, kafakapuko itoku wa, katata, kamama, kangaro haere o ito wa, kiamai o, aira, chakai, tetarai o, kawera, kamata, kafakapuko itoku wa. E kore au e mahi hawhi, hawhi. Oh.
Kotaia mua ki wāho, Māori maui te